It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaska produces some of the world's best shooters, and two of them join me for today's show. These are athletes with shotguns who can perform incredible feats of concentration, blasting clay targets out of the sky with consistency that no one else on Earth can match. In the first half of the show, we'll hear from Corey Cogdell Unrein, who learned to shoot at the Birchwood range before heading off to the Olympics three times, medaling twice, and recently becoming only the second American woman in history to medal in the World Cup of International Trap Shooting. In the second half, we have Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew McNamara, who recently came back from Texas as the world's best in his event after a perfect round of hitting 100 out of 100 targets. Like other elite athletes, these shooters have something special. In their case, a level of concentration and calm that is hard to imagine. I'll try to get some insight into how they are able to control their thoughts and emotions at that level, a skill that could help any of us. Well, for this part of the show, our guest is one of Alaska's greatest Olympians, one of the United States' greatest shooters, Corey Cogdell Unrein, who is from Eagle River. She's now in Chicago, where her husband plays for the Chicago Bears, and she's just had a pretty amazing accomplishment in an amazing career of accomplishments. Corey's been to the Olympics three times. She won a bronze medal in Rio. She also won a bronze in 2008 in Beijing, and she's just won a bronze at the women's trap at the World Cup final in Rome, only the second U.S. woman ever to medal in that competition. And so somebody who is really really rewriting the record books in a lot of ways, and comes from right here in Alaska. And thanks so much for being with us, Corey.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this level of competition has got to be a level of stress that is hard for most of us mortals to imagine, because, you know, in shooting, you either hit it or you don't. And I think we all know how that feels, sort of in sort of like wanting to hit your target and somehow being able to do it and not psych yourself out. And that's something that you must have gotten good at a long time ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely something that takes a lot of mental focus, definitely a lot of pressure that, you know, goes on during a competition and during training. You know, we're always trying to, you know, exceed to the next level. So, you know, we're just, you know, learning those mental techniques a lot to try and, you know, calm those nerves and really focus on what we need to.
Yeah, I just feel like that must be one of the keys to the sport. But when you get up to the Olympic or the World Cup level, does that raise to a whole new level, or is it you're just using the skills that you've learned and honed over time and trying not to think about the fact that you're at the very highest level?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you're at a World Cup competition or you're at the Olympics, it's a whole new level of pressure, that's for sure. You know, I was reminded once again competing in Rio that that level of pressure is something that you really just can't train for. You've just got to learn to deal with it in the moment. So, you know, looking back, you know, I can't even describe the feelings and the emotions that I had going into, you know, the Olympic competition, and then the day of the match, what those emotions felt like. You know, it's like you want to scream, cry, jump up and down, run away all at the same time, and knowing that you've worked so hard for the chance to win a medal on that one day, there's just a lot of emotions that go on.
I think it's, you know, to be able to get into the zone, which you have to be in your kind of shooting, because you got to get this instantaneous reaction. There's no thinking there. To be able to do that when you are in Rio at the Olympics and sort of the whole world is watching is part of what makes you guys kind of feel superhuman to the rest of us, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, looking back on the Olympics, you know, I have to, you know, remember when I was a little girl watching the Olympics and, you know, seeing those people walking into opening ceremonies, and they seem superhuman, and You know, it's such an incredible moment. And then, you know, to be that person myself, walking into opening ceremonies and knowing that I'm going to compete in the days to come, it's definitely a very surreal moment. And, you know, although I'm sure a lot of the people back at home, you know, see us as maybe, you know, superhuman, you feel very human and very humbled in that moment.
Yeah, I'm sure. So you've been to the Olympics three times, and I'm interested in your impressions of Rio and how you felt about the way the Olympics went on and how it compared to your other experiences.
Yeah, well, I think that each Olympics is definitely unique in its own way. You know, going to Rio, I knew that we could potentially have some challenges you know, set before us. You know, the Olympics has never been held in South America before. And just the economic, you know, situation in Rio was not the best going into the Olympics. But, you know, I think with all the obstacles that they had to overcome, they really did a good job of pulling it off. And, you know, I met a lot of the locals there, and they were very excited to have the Olympics there. They were very supportive of the athletes and excited to watch the events themselves. So, you know, I think overall, you know, they did a good job. We had some challenges here and there, that's for sure. You know, just kind of hiccups with our housing at the Olympic Village when we first got there. And, you know, we had some trouble with transportation, but you know, other than that, when you're trying to pull off such a huge event like that, you just have to go into it with the attitude of, you know, you're going to run into some problems and you just have to be patient. So,
yeah.
You know, comparing that to my previous two Olympics, you know, each one was so different. Beijing was my first. Beijing put so much money into really putting on a show for all the athletes and spectators. And the opening ceremonies will, you know, is one that I think will be hard to beat. Tokyo might be able to pull it off, but, you know, the opening ceremonies in Beijing was absolutely phenomenal, by far the best I've ever seen. And with it being my first Olympics, that was just so incredibly special.
It must have been, yeah.
You know, to have that realization of that dream.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
and then
the other one, in between, you didn't actually medal.
That's right. Yeah. So London, my experience itself in London was great. You know, London is an amazing city, English speaking country. So it was very easy for me to get around and really see a lot of, London. And that was a great experience. You know, my Olympic experience itself, you know, wasn't the best. I had, you know, a lot of distractions, during that Olympics. I had, some groups of people that, were protesting against me even competing in the Olympics because I hunt. And you know, that's something that, you know, I grew up doing. So of course I was very defensive of that, but, you know, I had some death threats and
you're kidding. Oh my gosh.
Purely because I hunt.
Coming from Alaska, that seems so weird. I mean, it seems so inconceivable, but I guess other people in other places have different ways of looking at things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of groups out there that, you know, really don't support hunting of any kind. And, you know, that's unfortunate because, you know, there's so many great things that come out of hunting, not only just the conservation aspect of you know, funding wildlife research and protection, but, you know, also maintaining healthy wildlife numbers. Without hunters, you know, we wouldn't have healthy populations of animals in our country. So,
right. You know, and it's also, if
a lot of the people that were attacking me really didn't care to hear any of those reasons. They just wanted to really be a distraction to me.
Well, that's part of our Alaska lifestyle too. It's sort of like not accepting somebody from a different part of the world who has a different lifestyle, which is something that, you know, we're all trying to do, I guess, you know, or we should all be trying to do, but it does.
Absolutely.
Sometimes it seems like it only goes one way.
You know, I definitely try and be tolerant of other people's beliefs and viewpoints, and, you know, in return, I hope that they're tolerant of my beliefs and my viewpoints. And you know, unfortunately that didn't happen in London, and it was definitely a huge distraction for me, and, you know, put a dampened my Olympic experience. But I learned a lot from that, and grew a lot from that, and became mentally tough. And I think that helped me go into Rio and win a medal.
Yeah, yeah, that had to be a great lesson. We're talking to Corey Cogdell Unrein, who's an Alaskan Olympian in shooting, and has also just become only the second U.S. woman ever to medal at the World Cup in Rome. Corey, I think that it would be worthwhile to explain to listeners who don't know much about the sport exactly what it is you do and in trap shooting, and how it might compare to what people might, what might be used to sort of on the range recreationally, or shooting that people might be accustomed to in sort of everyday life as compared to this international competition.
Absolutely. So I competed in a sport called international trap shooting. It's a clay target sport shot with a 12-gauge shotgun. Most people are probably familiar with what we call American trap or ATA trap. That's what you would find at your local gun club. Those targets fly about 45 miles per hour. The hardest angle you're going to get is a 17-degree left to right, and they're always going to fly at the same height. So international trap, which is what I shoot, is actually shot out of a 60-foot-long in-ground bunker. So it's level with the ground. Inside that, there's 15 trap machines. The targets are thrown 60 to 80 miles an hour, and the hardest angle you can get left to right is a 45-degree left to right, and they also vary in height from about 3 feet off the ground to about 15 feet. So you can get anything within that spectrum. So, you know, a lot of people hear trap and they think, oh, well, that's what I shoot, you know, at my local gun club. I go on the weekend and throw some trap. Similar because it's a going away from you target, but a lot different because it's quite a bit faster, harder angles, tougher target.
So it's really unpredictable as to what your next trap is going to be looking like when it gets in front of you.
Absolutely, yeah. It's all thrown off of a computer system. So the computer randomly selects which target you're going to get. All you know is through the course of 25 targets, everyone will get the same target. So you'll get two lefts, two rights, and a straightaway off of every station, but those are thrown randomly, so you don't know when you're going to get those targets.
Wow, that sounds really difficult. So how did you get into, what was your first encounter with that style like? I think that would have been, I don't know, but I assume you came up with the traditional American style.
I did. So I started competing in American style trap when I was in high school. I got started in the clay target shooting sports through a local 4-H program, and shot on a local youth trap team for a number of years.
Was it there in Birchwood? Was it the gun club there in Birchwood where you'd shoot?
I'm sorry, what was that?
I was just saying, was it the range there in Birchwood
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. I grew up shooting on Birchwood.
Okay. We can picture that.
Yeah. So, I was shooting on some local trap teams, and then randomly I just found out that, shooting was an Olympic sport, decided that I wanted to pursue that, and got invited to come and train at the Olympic Training Center for a 3-day camp with a bunch of other juniors. And that was the first time I was really exposed to the Olympic shooting sport.
Well, did you immediately find it much harder, or did you what was your reaction to it when you had these targets going off in all directions?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was a bit shocked the first time that I shot it. It was, and it seemed incredibly fast at the time, much harder angles, and I really didn't have any concept of a mental game, so that was definitely a huge handicap for me as well. Being 16 and trying it for the first time. So it was definitely a huge challenge, but at the same time, there was something about it that just kind of stuck me. And, I've always been the type of person that enjoys a challenge. So I think that kind of kept me coming back for more.
Yeah. So what was the, I'm interested when you say you weren't familiar with the mental game yet. What does that mean exactly? Like you were, hadn't yet learned the tricks to calm yourself down or to sort of get into the competition?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I am still learning parts of the mental game. When you really get at the top level of a sport like this, it's really very intricate details that play into having a successful competition. So, yeah, when I was just shooting ATA when I was, you know, 14, 15 years old, I really didn't know any of the tricks to kind of manage the thoughts that go through your mind, you know, all the positive and negative thoughts that pop up, you know, as you're going through a round, and whether you're doing bad or good, those thoughts are going to pop up, and you really have to learn how to deal with them and know how to manage them. So I didn't really have any concept of that, especially to the level that, you know, I needed to understand that to be successful at this game.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like.
With the amount of pressure that we're under going into various competitions.
Well, I don't know if that's something you could share with us, but I mean, what kind of tricks or what kind of sort of mental process do you go through to achieve that, especially something that you had to learn over time?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, at a very basic level, I always describe, you know, the thoughts that go through your mind like waves in the ocean. You know, you can't control the waves in the ocean, but you can learn how to surf them. So that's very similar to your mind. You can't really control the thoughts that go through your mind. You just learn how to deal with them and kind of navigate them. So, you know, for instance, you know, if I'm in a competition and, you know, it's coming down to the last couple shots and I know that, you know, I have a chance of making the final or winning a medal, you know, it's very often that those negative thoughts will pop up and, you know, you have that little thought that says, oh, well, don't miss this last target. Oh, well, what if you miss those last two targets? How horrible would that be? You know, those thoughts will pop up in your mind and you can't. There's no way you can ever stop yourself from thinking those, but you learn how to navigate them. So, you know, for instance, if something like that popped up in my mind, I would just I play a little game with myself that, you know, I'll say, oh, well, that's silly. You always break your last couple targets. Like, you do this all the time in practice. That's just a thought. You know, just refocus on, you know, your pre-shot routine, what you need to do. Focus on, you know, the positive things. So, you know, those are just kind of some of the techniques that I use. You're always, I always look at the mental game as a game that you play with yourself. And, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But, you know, if you always try and refocus those negative thoughts on a positive and realize that you're going to have negative thoughts, so don't get down on yourself about it. You just have to, you know, be able to refocus quickly on the things that you need to focus on to make a good shot. One of the books that helped me the most when I was first started out shooting was With Winning in Mind by Lanny Basham. And he really goes in detail about how to create those mental processes and how to break through those mental barriers that, you know, we set for ourselves, and we tend to perform within our comfort zone. So, you know, how to push your comfort zone to a new level so that you can achieve those top scores.
Yeah, and in this last competition in Rome where you won the medal, I guess you missed some shots, and then your competitor also did, but you were able to bring it back together, which I think is probably a very difficult mental skill. I mean, once you miss, then for a lot of us, that's sort of when you'd start to fall apart. But how were you able to get that, pull that together, and to sort of tell us a story about how that competition went?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that competition in particular was actually, I would say, a bit of a struggle for me. Going into the competition, I really wasn't able to train very much at all. Which is pretty uncommon for me. Unfortunately, where I'm at in Chicago, because of my husband's job, there's nowhere for me to train within about 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I went into that competition, you know, not having practiced a lot. So I definitely felt a little bit rusty technically. But, you know, I also know that, you know, I have really good fundamentals, and I felt like I was still in a really good place, you know, physically and mentally going into that match. So, you know, it was definitely a battle that whole match. We had some really tough lighting. You know, people weren't shooting the scores that, you know, we're kind of accustomed to shooting. And that's really when you see people kind of fall apart, when they think they have to shoot a certain score to make the final. And, you know, kind of once they get down past that score, a lot of people will fall well below that score because they just kind of give up. And, you know, that the whole match was just a battle for me to stay mentally focused and to keep myself, you know, upbeat and encouraged about how I was shooting, even though the scores were lower than normal. And that definitely came into play in the final when, like you said, I missed a couple of shots early. You know, I was trailing going into the last five or so shots. And I think just from my experience, you know, I've learned that, you know, you really can't ever give up. You got to try until the very last shot, because you never know when someone's going to miss, and you don't want to be looking back saying, well, gosh, I wish I wouldn't have given up because she missed her last two targets and I would have won if I just wouldn't have given up. So, you know, those are the kind of thoughts that I just try and remind myself of, you know, never give up, try your best until the last shot. And, you know, if your best isn't good enough, then it's not your day, but you don't want to walk off the line, you know, not having given your best.
Yeah, I guess that's a really good lesson for everybody in competition about that sticking in and having that toughness when somebody else doesn't could make the difference. Yeah. So my guest today is Corey Cogdall-Unrein, who is an Olympian from Eagle River. She's been to the Olympics three times, won bronze in trap shooting twice, and also a World Cup event that she just won, which was pretty historic. And she's talking to us from Chicago, where her husband, Mitch Unrein, is a member of the Chicago Bears in the NFL and plays defensive end. And, you know, that your life sounds very, very glamorous, right? You're traveling in international competition. Your husband is a pro football player. I guess you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds kind of like a dream come true sort of lifestyle you're living, getting to do the sport you love and travel around and do all this. Now you can tell us the downside of it.
Well, I definitely am very blessed to get to do what I do. And, you know, my husband has been very blessed to, you know, been able to play in the NFL. This is now his seventh year playing. You know, so we've been very blessed to get to do what we both love. But there's definitely highs and lows to, you know, living that lifestyle and being an athlete where you're, you know, always basically judged on what have you done for me lately. So, you know, there's definitely challenges of, you know, with his career, having to move multiple times. For instance, last year I actually had to move us about five times. We moved out to San Diego, and then we were unfortunately released there, but about 4 hours later we were picked up by the Bears. So then I moved us out to Chicago, and then I had to move our stuff back from San Diego to Colorado, where our home base is. And then, you know, at the end of the season, we moved back from Chicago. And once again, I had to go back out to San Diego to get more of our stuff and, you know, move. We moved so many times, I just feel like I lived out of a suitcase for about 6 months. So, you know, there's definitely some things that we're very blessed. And, you know, some people may think, oh, you know, it's very glamorous. And we do get to do some special things. But there's a lot of hard work and behind the scenes stuff that goes on that, you know, most people don't know about. And that, you know, what really, you know, you have to push through that stuff to continue to be able to focus on what you need to on those game days and competition days. Because, you know, everyone has those struggles, but not a lot of people see them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you guys are able to support each other, I guess, in a way most couples aren't, because you are both elite athletes. And I mean, your seasons kind of are opposite a little bit, right?
Yeah. Fortunately, our seasons only overlap for about 3 months out of the year, really. So when I'm done with my season in October, I'm able to really just focus on being there for him and helping him. And then when his season's done in, you know, January, February, he's able to focus on being there for me and, you know, kind of being the supporting role as I'm getting back to training. So, yeah, it's been a great experience to be able to be married to, you know, another professional athlete and really be able to understand, you know, those struggles and challenges that we both go through and, you know, knowing from our experiences how to support each other.
Yeah. So how long can this ride go on? I mean, I you know, football careers don't last forever, and I actually don't know how long shooting careers last. What is the arc for your guys' careers and life, and where do you see things going?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, hopefully my husband has a couple more good years of football playing ahead of him. I know he'd like to play for at least a couple more years. And then, you know, as far as shooting goes, it can really be endless. I mean, normally we have some of the oldest Olympians competing in the shooting sports. One of my teammates, she just competed in her sixth consecutive Olympics. So, you know, I could potentially definitely go to quite a few more if I was able to keep up training and stay in world class level.
Wow, that's great. You chose the right sport.
Yes, I hope so.
So in just a couple of minutes we have left, I wonder if you have any tips for shooters who might be among our listeners about how they can improve or what the sort of the keys are for just getting better at the sport. And I'm guessing you're going to say practice, but maybe there are some other maybe there's some other tips.
Well, practice is definitely a big part of it. You know, I practice, you know, a couple thousand rounds a month, if not more. So practice is a huge part. Also, you know, having a gun that really fits you well. With shotgun shooting, one of the most important aspects is gun fit. Unlike a rifle where you have sights that you're trying to line up and put a bullseye on a target, your eye is the back sight on a shotgun. So if your eye doesn't line up correctly with that front sight, your gun's not going to be shooting where you're looking. So that's also, you know, a very important part. And there's some more inexpensive ways to change gun fit. You can take some moleskin if your comb is too low and build up that moleskin on the top of the comb and help you, you know, raise your point of impact, essentially. You know, you can get adjustable butt plates. You know, you can add spacers. If you need a gun longer, you can cut it shorter. If you need it shorter, there's a lot of easy, inexpensive ways to tweak gun feet so it'll be an improvement. You don't just have to go buy a custom stock, that's for sure. And then, you know, I always just tell people, go out there and have fun. You know, if you're trying shotgun shooting for your first time, you know, don't go out there and expect to hit every target. The first time I ever went out, I think I hit 3 out of 25 targets. So, you know, definitely just go out there, have fun with it, be patient, and practice hard.
Yeah, and then you might end up having a lifelong career, or more probably you'll just have a good time. Well, thanks so much, Corey Cogdell Unrein, Alaska Olympian. We're so proud of our Olympians, and you have really accomplished some amazing stuff. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us on Outdoor Explorer. We have another Alaskan shooting champion with us after the break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. We're talking today about skeet shooting. Right now I'm with Andrew McNamara, Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew McNamara, who has come back from a pretty incredible achievement in terms of his shooting prowess. He's stationed here in Anchorage, and he did something that has very rarely been done in terms of the success he had in international shooting. And, you know, and I thought maybe to start out with, you could, Andrew, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe you could just tell us about, like, what this competition is all about and sort of what you do, you know, to get there. Because, I read about it in the ADN, and I realized that at this level of shooting that you're at, you essentially can't miss, right?
Definitely not. Once you miss, it's one miss, you're out for the most part.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about, like, what is the, to paint the picture for me a little bit, where you were and, you know, what you accomplished.
So what I shoot, I actually shoot American skeet. It's a four-gun event opposed to international skeet,
okay,
which is a shot only with the 12-gauge. Instead, with American skeet, we have to shoot the 12, the 20-gauge, the 28, and the 410. And I was down in San Antonio competing in the World Skeet Championships, and I went out and shot a 100 out of 100 targets with the 410. There were seven of us that completed the 100, and then we had to shoot off for the actual world title as the 410 world champion. And they started to go out pretty quick, and it only took three stations and a shoot-off, sudden death. It took six targets for me to actually win my first world title.
Wow, best in the world.
For the 410. There is still somebody who won the overall with all the events added together, was still, so technically I'd say he's the best in the world, but out of the seven events that you can win a world title, I'm one of the seven in the world that won a title.
But that's really amazing, and it's really cool that you are, you know, from Alaska. Is that your best event, the 410?
I wouldn't say it's my best event. I mean, it definitely was my best event this year, I would say. But you know, every time you shoot, you go out there, and a lot of skeet shooters know that you have to, especially on that level, that you have to shoot 100 out of 100 targets to do anything when you go to the Worlds. And if you don't, it's kind of frustrating, because, you know, hey, I went all this way, and then I missed one, now I'm out. So, I mean, that's the hard part. Early in the competition, I'd missed five targets in the 20-gauge event, and it's frustrating, because you go all this way, you travel, you know, 2,000-plus miles to get down, and you get there, and you spend all this money to be there, and then you don't perform at your top. But, you know, the thing to remember is that the next day there's another event. And the day after I missed the five, I went out and actually ran the 100 with the 28-gauge, and I took third in my class out of the, I think there was 38 people that ran the 100 that day. And then the next day with the 410, it was just a windy day, and I knew there was one person that was perfect going into it. He was sitting on a 350 out of 350, and before we went out to shoot, we'd seen that he'd already missed one, so I was like, hey, you know, he's one of the best in the world. He's a retired master sergeant from the Air Force, actually, who used to shoot on the team with us years ago. And I was like, all right, well, you know what? It's a windy day. Anything could happen. And then I went out and did what I needed to do. But it when you go out there and it's real windy and you go to a new event, it's just one target at a time. And that's the getting in your own head is the hardest part of ski
shooting. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is like any skill where you can do 100 out of 100 times, you've got to be able to reach some kind of like zen, right? Where you're just like, somehow you're just like not going to, you're just going to be totally confident, and somehow you're going to get to the next shot, and you're not, you know, I don't know how you would do that. I mean, it almost seems like superhuman to even be able to hit 100 out of 100 on a consistent basis.
And, you know, that's the hardest part of it, is the consistency, is because most skeet shooters, pretty much all skeet shooters, have hit every single target on the skeet field. It's just whether you can put them all together and do it consistently through those four sets of 25. And that's the hardest part, is continuing to hit each target as they come out and knowing that, you know, you can do this, and your mind starts to create things, you know, starts to make you second guess.
Yeah,
I guess would be the best way to put it.
Got to keep your mind clear.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's one target, and that's all you got to remember. Don't think about another target. Just think about the one that you're going after first, because you have to hit it.
Well, yeah, in a way, it's different from some sports where you're trying to accomplish something that's a big reach. What you're trying to do here is avoid a mistake, right?
Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of avoiding the negative.
You know, and that day that I ran the 100 with the 410, I actually remember it was a low five. Target came, it was crossing from right to left, and I chipped probably a piece off the back of it, the size of a nickel. And I came off the station, and I was just like, well, I just smashed that one, and the whole squad laughed because they're trying to keep it, you know. Try and keep me relaxed.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things that you got to get out of your mind and just go, you know what? It's over. Don't think about that. I barely hit that target. You know,
yeah.
Because an X on paper is still an X on paper. When the scorekeepers look at it at the end of the day, it's still 100 hits. It's not 99 solid hits in one chip. It's still an X on the paper, and that's all that matters at the end of the day.
Are you a really easygoing guy just in everyday life? I mean, that you're able to manage your emotions and not get keyed up about stuff and not get stressed out. I'm just curious as to sort of what the personality type is that leads to success in this sport.
Well, some people might argue that one, that I'm that easygoing, depending on work or home life, depending. But I mean, for me, it's just when you get onto the skeet field, it's always been, it's business. It's not, I don't have my phone on me. I don't like people laughing and joking. It's just because when I get out there, it's like a light switch gets flipped on and I am serious, ready to go.
Yeah.
It's just, you got to focus. And especially when you go and you spend the time and the effort to get to that level and then you don't do well because of something. I want to make sure I give myself the best opportunity and not put myself at jeopardy for missing something because I'm laughing and joking with somebody next door.
Yeah, yeah. So interesting. And I have so many questions. I want to learn how you got that way and how you developed your skills and maybe get some tips for listeners who are interested in shooting. Talking to Andrew McNamara, he's a sergeant in the Air Force and best in the country at skeet shooting with a 410 and probably way better at skeet shooting with any gun that any of us would pick up or listening right now, so we can learn a lot from him. Show is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm Charles Woolforth. So let's tell people about the type of targets you're using and how they are released down the field. There's different types of targets and different patterns for different types of skeet shooting, right?
Yes. Depending on where you're located, sometimes they use a biodegradable target. Most places use a white flyer target. That's just the brand of the target. The ones in San, like up here in Alaska, they use an all orange because of the background and how you see them. And, excuse me. And down in San Antonio, they use a pitch target that is half black and half with, orange dome top. Sorry. Reset for that. It's a black with orange dome, so they're painted so you get two tone as they come out of the window. Some people complain about them because they're hard to see and they're not what they're used to because people are used to an all orange target. It takes a little bit to get used to, but once you pick up on it, it's pretty easy to identify and pick up. But they're coming out of the trap at 45 miles an hour, so it's just that flash, and really that's all you're picking up. You're not going to be able to see each line that's on the target and say you can see it because you don't. The eye doesn't pick it up that quick.
Yeah. Is it, there's the shooting club out in Birchwood, and that's basically the type of shooting you're talking about, right? Do you work out there or do you work out on base? Or?
I shoot at both locations. Uh-huh. I shoot on the base for practice a lot, and then I shoot the state championship up at Birchwood every year. Each year that I've been up here. So the last 3 years I've competed up there.
So if our listeners are skeet shooters, they're probably doing the same type of skeet shooting that you are doing as opposed to international, which is rather different.
Yeah, they have one location, I believe. It's, I don't quote me, I think it's Grouse Ridge. It's a new shooting complex that actually offers international.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been up to it yet. I haven't made it up there. But most of the people in the local area are going to compete at either Birchwood or on the base at the J-Bear skeet range.
So you're from Vermont originally.
Yes, sir.
And I'm sure you've seen shooters all over the country now because of your competition. How does our local group and our state shooters, who are obviously amateurs, compare to what you see around the country?
In terms
of level of competition and all that.
So when that's every place you go, there's different types of shooters, I guess, and different every place that I've shot. I mean, I was stationed in England, and that's where I actually started shooting. And the shooters over there are just insanely good.
Huh.
Just it was either, and I think honestly, they credit a lot of how good my shooting became because it was either you either ran 100 or you didn't win anything.
Wow.
Over there, because pretty much every event you could count on somebody running a perfect score in one of the events at least.
Okay, so I totally would not expect England to have a gun culture that was like that, right?
Yeah, no, you know, that's the hardest thing is like when I first got over there, I wanted to start shooting a lot more because they have a range right across the street from the fighter base over there, and it took forever. It felt like forever to get a gun permit to actually bring a gun into the country because so many. They have to do background checks. You have to have a safe. There's so many laws and rules about how you transport and what you can have. And, you know, being an American over there, they're like, eh. So I don't know if they waited a little bit, but I finally got it. And that's what, you know, just made me just start shooting.
Uh-huh.
Sold my motorcycle and started dedicating time to shoot and skeet.
So we have the English to credit a little bit for you being our champion.
There's one, you know, person that I'd never run a perfect, because a standard round is 25 shells, mm-hmm. which is a box of shells, standard box. And I hadn't run a perfect 25 out of 25 until I went to the club one day and I went looking. Somebody told me, find Peter Bloomfield. He'll help you out. I went and found him and he's like, all right, well, go get started. I'll come meet you. And kind of a little hesitant to help, it seemed at first, but I went out there and he showed me what I was doing wrong or told me what I was doing wrong.
Huh.
And then that day I ran my first 25 out of 25. Next day, a perfect 50 out of 50. And then I think it was about 3 months later, I ran my first 100 out of 100. And it was just, he really
took me
under.
So interesting. So it just clicked. Like this piece of advice he gave you, just it made you click.
Yeah, it's because I was pretty much on, out of the 8 stations that are on the field in a standard round of ski, I was having trouble with one station uh-huh. in particular.
Tell me, what was that?
It was a high 2.
Okay, and what does that mean?
So it's the second station. It's slightly on an angle. It's for mm-hmm. a right-handed shooter. It's probably one of the more difficult shots on the field.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a low 6 because of the angle for a left-hand shooter is probably one of their most difficult targets. It's just the angle uh-huh. of it and how close you are and how fast it goes out.
I'm curious what advice he gave you that would made such a big difference.
I honestly, it was 9 years ago.
It was
so
a little thing, yeah.
I don't probably, it was probably stopped thinking about it. I know when I was around and I was about, I think I was on the second to last station and I told him, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm about to run a perfect 25 here. And he's like, oh, come on, stop gabbing. Let's go. You know, don't mess it up now. Just focus and go.
Those Brits aren't very emotional, are they?
Oh, you know, he's funny. He's all business too. And I think that's uh-huh. where I got a lot of my style from. Is that he really pulled me under his wing and helped me out. And he helped a lot of shooters throughout the years, you know, in the military, actually make it onto their branch of service team.
Sweet. So tell me about that in terms of serving in the military. How does sports and, you know, shooting fit in with your service? Are you now, like, just focused on skeet shooting, or are you still, like, working out on the J-Bear, doing a job as an Air Force member?
Yeah, I still, so the way the Air Force works it, you have your regular day job, and then what we do is we go temporarily off and compete. So it's not an AFSC, it's not a primary job. Like the Army, they uh-huh. have an Army marksman unit where that is their sole job. 5 days a week, they're shooting targets or, you know, depending on their discipline,
mm-hmm.
doing different events for higher-ups and whatnot, but that's mm-hmm. their sole job. But for the Air Force, we still have our main focus of our job, and then we go and compete when we have time, basically.
I see. So what's your job out on J-Bear? What are you doing?
So I'm an aircraft mechanic.
Okay. And so which kind of – do you guys, like, work on all different kinds of planes, or I'm just curious how that works?
So I work on the C-17.
Okay, the big ones.
Yeah, it's not the big – I mean, C-5's a little bigger. I worked uh-huh. on those before, so – It's a nice medium size.
Interesting. So how long have you been here in Anchorage?
Just about 3 years now.
Okay. And you've been in the service quite a while. Have you had to move around quite a bit?
So I've moved around. I was in Europe. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Hawaii.
Oh, nice.
And then I got stationed up here.
Yeah.
Hard assignments. So
get that letter in the mail. You got to go to Hawaii to Alaska. It didn't sound so great.
Yeah. You know, you can't. I don't think you can beat Alaska in the summertime. It is just so amazing up here. But the winters sometimes get a little difficult.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How have you found the community up here? Have you enjoyed living in Anchorage?
Oh, I do. I mean, I just love Alaska. It is just, you know, after growing up in Vermont and then to come up here, you know, it was always a dream to visit Alaska, I put it that way. And when I first came in, I remember putting on my dream sheet, like I wanted to go to Alaska. And that's probably 90% of the Air Force wants to go to Alaska.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's just Hawaii and Alaska are the number one, number two picks for where people want to go. So,
And so many people end up here too. They end up retiring here.
They do, yeah. It's, you know, it's such a pro-military community, and just so many people to support. And you, it's hard to not go somewhere and then have people. I mean, anytime you go into Sam's Club or Costco and you're picking up something and you're in uniform, there's so many people that stop you and just say, "Hey, thank you for your service." And you know, for me, it's. It's like small, you know, for what
kind
I did,
small town,
what I did compared to what, you know, my grandparents did, you know, when they joined and or were forced to join, you know, what I chose to join. So it's, I try and thank the people, especially the veterans that stop you and say thank you. And they're wearing, you know, the caps that have, you know, Vietnam vet or, they're the people, you know, that really deserve the thank you and the respect more.
Well, I think you do too. I mean, you're part of a service that is defending the country, and you are ready to be sent off wherever you need to be sent. Right? It's like you given your life to the service. So that's something I think a lot of people appreciate, just because it's I'm not doing it. Right? I'm making my own choices. Yeah,
it's my pleasure. It's
cool.
It's definitely been a fun experience.
So what kind of support do you get from the military for your sport? Do you have to like pay for your own plane tickets to get to these competitions and entry fees and stuff like that?
It all depends on the budget for the year and what they have available from the non-appropriated funds, the non-tax dollar.
I see.
Pot of money there. They, you know, certain years we've had our entry fees paid for and our ammo and whatnot. But the thing that we get that is like gold to us is that our units allow us to go on a permissive TDY down to the location for two and a half weeks away from work, non-charged leave. So we're not using our own leave to actually go, because it's kind of, some people say it's a vacation, but at the same time, it's work while you're down there. I mean, we have days that we start shooting at the 9 a.m. flight, and we're still shooting off and shoot offs at 9 p.m. at night.
Wow.
And it comes down
to... It's exhausting, actually.
Yeah, you know, and that's sometimes the hardest part of shooting down there is that you have an early flight time and you go out and you're doing your best. And then if you do shoot well and you do get that perfect 100 out of 100, then it's the wait. What do you do from 10:30 all the way till 4:30 in the afternoon to keep yourself kind of in that game mode of I still got to be on my game, but not doing too much to actually pull you out of that mindset where you're ready to win.
I mean, I would think that most people would see that having a super successful team like you've got is beneficial to the military, because it's, you know, we're proud of you guys doing it, and you're in the newspaper and you're on the radio, and so that's, you know, showing you in a positive light. How many are on your team?
So we run primarily a five-man team. Mm-hmm. In the years past, years upon years ago, when it was a fully funded operation, it was a 10-man team. But then just over the years, we went down to a 5-man team. So we have five individuals, and they come in from all over. This year, we had two of us from Alaska, one from South Dakota, Las Vegas, and I don't even...
So covering the entire Air Force.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing that the Air Force... So basically, the Air Force for the American ski team, they pick the top five people that have the best scores for the year and send them off to the World Championships. You always have some people that are a little bit better for the year, but they can't make it because of either work or leave, baby leave, deployments, etc. There's always something. So I just go down through and I find who has the best averages, and you rack and stack, because this is what you want to do. You want to go and compete, because when you get there, you're competing as an individual, but for the Air Force side of it, you're competing as a five-man world military team. So, and that's what they look for. They want the military championships, and they want the team military championships. But when you come out and win a world championship, they're just like, Holy smokes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So my guest is world champion in the 410 skeet shooting and serves in the Air Force here in Anchorage. He's Sergeant Andrew McNamara, and really, really pleased to have him in for the show today on Outdoor Explorer. You said you're originally from Vermont. What's your hometown like?
It's small. No traffic lights.
Uh-huh.
No stores. No fire department. There's a school.
Uh-huh.
And a town hall.
And is shooting a big part of life there as it is in Alaska?
I would think so. I mean, there's a lot of people moving into Vermont now. So, you know, the certain areas that I used to grow up hunting and whatnot are slowly dwindling.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So how did you get into the sport originally? Is it something that was just part of your family, or did you pick it up after you got in the military?
Yeah, I actually started shooting, I think I was about 9 years old. I went to my local gun club. It's actually a gun club that my whole family, actually my father, my brother, and then I were directors at the gun club before I went off to the military.
Huh.
And it's just a local place there, the Berry Fishing Game.
Uh-huh.
And they have two skeet fields there, and I started shooting with a little 410 single shot. And that's where, you know, they do leagues up there and whatnot. And I think it's Wednesday night, you go up there and shoot. And that's where I really started to shoot. And it wasn't until later on that I actually started hitting, you know, the perfect rounds and made it and started shooting competitively.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't realize you had a great aptitude from this right off the bat. It took some time of being sort of more of an average shooter before you sort of started to really gain your ability.
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, it takes a lot to. I mean, I always enjoyed shooting skeet, and it was always fun. And if you know, after when I was in school, and when I was working after high school, it was hey, it's Wednesday, let's go shoot. Just because it's something that's fun to do. I really enjoy it. Sometimes shooting competitively is not as enjoyable because
stress.
There's the stress, and there's the. You want to perform, you want to do well, and you want to win. I mean, that's what my wife says. I am overly competitive.
Uh-huh.
I say I'm not, but she says it doesn't matter what we're doing. You know, I'm going to be competitive, but it's just the way I am. And it's always for skeet. It's, you know, you get that 20, it's achievements. And it's always, you know, you want to keep going until you get to the top. And it's just, you get that 25 and then you get a 50 and then you get the 75. And then when you get that 100, it's like, all right, now I'm hooked. And that's what really got me hooked.
They got to have that drive.
And now, you know, and then it's, you want to get 100. You get 100 one time. Well, now you got to do it in four guns and then do it in the doubles event as well. So it's like there's always an achievement to do. And
that's what gets you to put all those hours in, right? Is that drive and the desire to be better. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and it's so, it's frustrating when you get there and you've broken the target hundreds and hundreds of times. I mean, for registered competitions, I've shot, I think it's just about 32,000 registered targets since 2007.
Wow.
But I've probably shot at least that in practice, you know, but mm-hmm. You've shot all these targets and you know you can do it. And then you make a simple mistake and it's like, why did I just do that?
Right.
You know,
so it's almost about perfection. You gotta be perfect.
It is. And that's where, you know, some people don't like to shoot competitively because they know, I mean, especially at the World Shoot, you go there and you miss and you're out. But the thing is, you know, the National Skeet Shooting Association has set it up to try and help people, you know, to bridge that gap to go from, hey, I like to shoot a gun here and there to I want to start shooting competitively. So what they do is they set it up with different classifications. So starting at the top, you have a AAA average shooter, which is a 98 or better average out of 500 targets.
Wow.
All the way down to a D and E class shooter, who's down in like the 80th percentile.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you, you know, you can go to the world shoot and you can actually win a class event. So it's not... So if you're a new shooter, you're not going up there competing against Paul
chance,
Jabron, who's won 19 times, or, you know, Todd Bender, guy mm-hmm. who's won 30, 40 plus, I think.
So what do you have any tips for sort of recreational shooters in terms of getting better at skeet shooting? I mean, what kind of advice would you give to people for how they could improve their technique or their skills or their success level?
You know, they have videos out. There's a... Mm-hmm. There's always videos and there's some books out. It depends on how you learn.
Coaching is real important.
There's coaching. And they always, I'd say a lot of people recommend you take lessons. You know, you can take lessons, and different people do them. And it depends on who you are as a shooter, and whether it will help you or not. And you got to know yourself kind of a little bit. But the thing, you know, one of the best pieces of advice that I ever received was in England. I was told, hey, every shooter is going to want to come up and tell you how to do something. The thing is, listen to everybody, whether they're talking to you for 5 or 10 minutes, because in that 5-10 minutes, there might be a 10-second window that they tell you something that changes your game. And just treat everybody's advice like it is something you're going to use, and then only take what you need out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's got advice out there why you shouldn't hold your gun this way and why you shouldn't do that way. And I mean, you know, prime example, if you look at the gun that I shoot and you were to pick it up, some people swear I'm a left-handed shooter because of the way I have my adjustable comb, basically the stock of the gun, adjusted. It's just how it's my shooting style.
Mm-hmm. And what you've learned over many years and many, many rounds.
Yeah. 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 So yeah. I think I've gone through 5 different guns over the years.
Uh-huh. So what happens next for you? Do you see yourself going back and winning again, maybe upping your number of wins, or, you know, would you continue to do this when you retire from the military? What's your future in the sport?
I definitely think I'll continue. I mean, it's just it's just one of those things you can always do better. I mean, and yes, I won a world title, but at the same time, I only won the 410. There's still...
That's all, right?
Yeah, you say it like that, and it, you know, people are like, hey, you know, you are the best in the world at the 410.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I am. But there's still the 12, the 20, the 28, the doubles event, the high overall, which is the 4 of them added together, and then the high all around, which is the 5 of them added together. So you can always be... And that's what the guy who won the four guns added together, he missed one target out of 450.
Wow.
I mean, he is the best in the world right now. I mean, he's just an all-around great shooter, and that's what...
So that's your goal, huh?
Yeah, even my wife joked about it. She's like, it wasn't the high overall. She's like, you could do it. You know you can do it. And I was like, it's just actually doing it. You know, in 2013, I placed 6th in the world. I missed 3 targets out of 450, and that was my best achievement up until this one. And so in 2012, I won the A class. I was in A class, and I won the high overall. And for me, that was pretty good. I think it was 11th overall out of the world shoot. And then the next year, I went back, and I classed up into double A class. Well, then I won the double A class high overall. And to me, that was by far the best achievement I'd done in the ski world. This time, going back, you know, having a year off and then going back, and to actually win a ring. I mean, that's your ultimate goal in the end, is that to get the ring.
That competition keeps you going. Well, thank you so much, Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew McNamara, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's all for today's show. Thanks to Corey Cogdell Unrein, who was with us in the first half. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Doro, who booked today's show. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.